Hi, I'm Nick Gregoriadis, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. Hey everyone, we got a great show lined up for you today. It is Henry Akins. Henry is a standout teacher of Jiu-Jitsu and a very interesting cat. And I think you guys are going to thoroughly enjoy the show. But before we get on to the interview, please remember that you guys can get 10% off all of our fantastic instructional material. We've got Beyond Technique 1 and 2, Yoga for Grapplers, BJJ Building Blocks, the Black Belt Blueprint, Beyond the Black Belt, Progressive Jiu-Jitsu, Flow Jiu-Jitsu, and a whole bunch of other cool Jiu-Jitsu learning materials. A lot of effort, a lot of thought, and a lot of love is put into all those programs, and they will definitely help your Jiu-Jitsu get better. To get any of them for 10% off, head on over to store.jiu-jitsubrother.com and put in the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and you'll get that discount. Okay, guys, here we go. Next episode with Henry Akins. Enjoy. Hey guys, this is episode 28 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brothered Show. Hard for me to believe that we have come this far. It seems like just yesterday that I started this show. And it's also kind of cool to know that I can get Jiu-Jitsu luminaries / celebrities like our guest today, which is Henry Akins, widely regarded as one of the best teachers working in Jiu-Jitsu today. Such a pleasure for us to have him on the show. Henry, thank you so much for coming on, bud.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Nick. I guess this has been a long time coming.
It has.
Because we've heard about each other and known about each other for so long, and I think this is kind of our first real conversation. So it's awesome to be able to be on and chat with you.
Uh-huh. I got to tell you, I was training with one of my students in London, mm-hmm. and he's a tough brown belt. You know, he's decent. He's definitely no joke. Alan, shout out to you if you're listening. And I've been working with a very specific principle from Half Guard. And he did this move, or he was doing a specific body mechanic to counter what I was doing. It was the exact thing that I'd been working on. And I just said to him straight up, "Where did you learn that?" And he just goes, "Henry Akins." And I was like, "Okay, cool. This he's on the level, definitely." So that's really cool. I've been hearing a lot of good stuff about your invisible jiu-jitsu and your mind blown club. Using a lot of your stuff. I haven't actually got a login for it. I haven't bought the program yet, but just the way you've laid out your content is really cool, and it's given me some ideas, so I really appreciate that already.
Cool, good.
Yeah, bud, that's awesome. So, Henry, I wanted to try a few different things with this interview, because I'm kind of getting bored of asking people the same questions over and over again, so I wanted to try something a little bit different. When I say the word jiu-jitsu to you, what is the first thing that comes to your mind?
The first thing that comes to my mind is just spiritual development.
Wow. Okay. This is going to be a good one. That's great. Tell me, can you tell me a little bit more? Can you flesh that out for us a little bit more?
You know, it's funny because you asked what's the first thing that came to your mind. And when you said jiu-jitsu, it was just a flash of kind of white. And then the gi came to my mind, you know, and then I kind of started thinking about people rolling. But for me, and this is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about teaching jiu-jitsu, is it's been one of the most amazing and powerful tools for myself for personal development. And as I travel around and I teach seminars, you know, I'm constantly talking to people and they're telling me how much jiu-jitsu has benefited their life or helped them in life. And you know, that for me, I think we're all looking for some type of purpose in life that's greater than ourselves. And jiu-jitsu has given me the means to kind of feel like I'm contributing some good to the world, that I'm benefiting people's lives in a way that's better, that's bigger than just, okay, teaching someone how to fight or teaching someone self-defense.
That's awesome. You know? Good for you. I respect that a lot, Henry. So can you tell me a little bit about the journey that you took? I mean, are you fourth degree, or what's your rank at the moment?
I am a third degree.
Third degree. Okay, cool.
So I guess it really just depends on what grading system or what. I've been a black belt for, it'll be 14 years. It'll be 14 years now. 3 months.
Wow.
So
okay.
That was nice. So maybe I'll be a fourth degree.
I think you're
this
your
year.
Fourth degree. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, I'll be a fourth degree sometimes this year.
Good for you, man. And can you tell me a little bit about, this is one of those questions that I'm bored of asking, but everyone gives a different answer, so it still works out. Can you tell me about your journey, like what's brought you to this place as a fourth degree black belt?
Yeah, I guess everyone's journey is really, really unique, you know. For me, the process for me started, I was living in Oklahoma, going to high school in Oklahoma. I had a lot of friends that were wrestlers. Oklahoma is a huge wrestling state. And I was always very, very into the martial arts. I grew up watching martial arts on TV, you know, every weekend with my brothers. And for me, the reason that I was so into the martial arts is because there was an aspect of discipline and honor and things that, you know, involved in the martial arts that I was seeing that's not so much in sports. And so I was doing Taekwondo when I was in Oklahoma, but I was always looking for a martial art that was similar to wrestling because I knew how effective wrestling was as an art form, as a form of combat. So, you know, the wrestlers in high school were always considered like the toughest guys. They were always the most effective when it came to fighting. And I saw how effective, you know, in Oklahoma, it's not much to do in high school. So, you know, kids are drinking and fighting all the time. And I just recognized like, wow, these, you know, small wrestlers are able to take down these big giant football players mm-hmm. and dominate them. And then when the first few UFCs came out, that really was my introduction. I had seen the Gracie in action actually a couple months before the first UFC. So I was already aware who Royce Gracie was. And I already kind of had my money on Royce to win the tournament. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of the affirmation that I needed, like, wow, okay. This guy just went through and, you know, just basically effortlessly was able to beat everyone in this tournament, all these other different martial arts styles. And so I realized, okay, that's, you know, that's what I've been looking for. And because I was so into martial arts, I was like, okay, I'm going to make sure I commit myself to this 100%. And so I ended up moving out to California to train with Hickson.
Okay. And so you arrive at Hickson's Academy and you're a white
yep.
belt.
Yeah, so I arrived as a white belt, had a little bit of money saved up, didn't know anyone in California. I'd actually come out a few months before just to train during spring break and find the school, which was a chore in itself trying to find the school because this was before the days of internet, mm-hmm. you know, and so mm-hmm. you're looking through the yellow pages and stuff like that trying to find, and he wasn't in the yellow pages, and so you're asking, you know, asking around and called the Torrance Academy at the time. It was called the Torrance Academy, They were not very helpful in helping me find Hickson at all. Mm-hmm. So end up finding him. And I was just training so much at the academy that after a couple of weeks, because I was basically there from morning to evening, they gave me a job as a secretary.
Okay.
And so, you know, so from then on, the first year and a half, I was basically at the school 70 hours a week from 7 in the morning till 7 at night. On Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and from 7 to 9 on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Wow, that's cool. And you just soaked up. It's kind of like I call it the full immersion. It's pretty hard to not get better and not learn something when you're living in that kind of, or when you've devoted yourself and you've kind of dived in the fish pond.
Yeah. The crazy thing is, you know, I had no distractions. Mm. So I didn't have a girlfriend. I didn't have friends. I didn't know anybody when I moved to California. You know, and I kind of was like, okay, I moved out here for a specific purpose. So I sacrificed a lot to be able to come out to California, left my family, left all my friends, everyone I knew to move out. And so, yeah, I just kind of 100% committed myself to that. And it helped a lot not having any distractions, you know?
Yeah, it's that single-minded focus. I really believe that if you, even an average human being, if you have that single-minded focus, you can achieve far, far more than you think. And I've noticed that there's a lot of guys who've very quickly progressed in jiu-jitsu. I consider Kit Dale to be one of them, myself as well, you. It's, we all share a similar story in a way, which is like, that was our thing. I mean, you eat, breathe, sleep, shit jiu-jitsu for X number of years, and it's not surprising that we all got better quite quickly, you know. And then I guess other dudes want to, you know, train once or twice a week and you know, come to class late, and then they wonder why they're not progressing as fast as a guy like yourself. So that's right. Interesting to me.
Well, there's nothing wrong with coming, you know, like with doing that, coming. I think as long as you're training, it's going to benefit your life. But definitely, if you want to get better, the more you train, the more you commit to it, the more you invest in it, the better you're going to get quicker.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I'm kind of the opinion that I don't want to say I disagree with you, but I do slightly, in that I don't think it's so much a question of quantity. Obviously, the variable of quantity does play a role. I think once a week is definitely not enough to progress quickly. But I think it's far more, to me, the quality of your training and the intensity that you bring to it that are more important variables. That's just my opinion. But I guess some people would argue that you need both.
Well, I mean, I think the more you immerse yourself, the more you're putting time into it, the quicker your body adapts. And it's really neuromuscular training, mm-hmm. right? It's training it so that you don't have to think anymore. And when you do something, when you repeat a specific movement or series of movements so quick, so often, it comes to a point where your mind just, your body automatically goes to what its natural response is. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm sure with you, you don't, a lot of times when you roll, you don't have to think about what move you're going to do. It just happens.
Yeah.
If you, like Salo has a quote where if you think you're late,
yeah.
and that's, you know, that just comes with the time that's committed into mm-hmm. it.
I agree 100%. It's one of my favorite things actually is it doesn't even need to be full on move or a strangle or an arm lock or a sweep or anything. But when I do a little micro movement without thinking, and then I'm just like, how the fuck did I do that? And then I realize, okay, it's because you practiced it 600 times over the last 10 years or whatever. And it's just a part of you now. I love it when that happens. It's one of my very favorite things about training jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Henry, tell me, you were training 70 hours a week. You were the secretary of the academy. And I guess what I'm trying to get out of you is, how did you go from that to being this badass fourth degree legendary instructor and one of Hickson's black belts?
I just never quit. You know, yeah. there was plenty of times in throughout my career where it did come across my mind, where I had thought about it, but I just never allowed myself to give up.
And why, if I could just stop you, why, okay, could you tell us why that happened? What brought you to the point where it did cross your mind?
There was a point in time where one of my training partners, one of my best friends, Hickson's son, Hoxson, had passed away.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was a very, very difficult time for me emotionally, you know, going to the academy, being on the mats, just reminded me of him and made me think of him. And it was.
I understand.
Just a super difficult time. Because we were training partners, you know, he was like, we were coming up through the ranks together, mm-hmm. training all the mm-hmm. time together. He was like one of my best friends. So he was at my house all the time. And at the time, you think in your mind, like, gosh, this person's going to be around forever. We're going to be black belts together. You kind of create all these expectations in your mind.
Sweet.
And so, you know, I was 25 when that happened. And,
Well, yeah, Henry, I mean, everyone can hear that it's a scar that cut you real deep, dude. And, I once heard something which always stuck with me in you've just reminded me of it now, which is actually a hypnotist. He was trying to help someone get over a breakup. And he said, when you break up with someone or when you lose someone, the intensity of that breakup is proportionate to the amount of the size of the future you had built in your mind with them. So if you're just seeing a chick and it's just a fling, or if you've just got a buddy that you go out and have beers with and then you never see him again, it doesn't really hurt. But when it's someone that, as you said, you thought you were going to be black belts together and you thought it was going to be a lifelong friend of yours, I can understand why that, goddamn, that's terrible. That's absolutely terrible. And thank you for being able to share it.
No, my pleasure. I didn't. What's so crazy is, you know, after that, I kind of locked myself in my room for 3 months, and I was pretty in a pretty deep state of depression, just crying every day for hours and hours a day. You know, you weep and you think you're over it, and then it's so funny just talking about it again kind of brings back those feelings and brings back those emotions. And
man, you know,
you think you're over it, you know, you think you've dealt with it, and you think you've kind of like, okay, this is a part of my life, and you know, I've dealt with, and I've man, even in the past couple of years, I've, you know, mourned it, and, you know, but wow, yeah.
You know, I just got to say, to try to maybe lighten this, I respect you so much for sharing that, and I think it's so fucking cool. To me, I don't know you, Henry. I mean, this, we've chatted a bit on Facebook. I don't know you yet, but I love the fact that you could show that vulnerability. It says a lot. It says a lot about you as a man, and I respect that. And I don't even need to know. I don't even need to roll with you to know that you're a jiu-jitsu master, because that vulnerability, it's not easy to show something like that. I respect that very much, my friend. Thank you for that.
Well, you know, when you're training with people, I mean, and I'm sure you've been training for a long time, you know this too, the bond that you build with your training partners, the trust that develops between training partners is, I always tell people, one of the biggest blessings of jiu-jitsu to me is all the relationships I've developed in life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You
know? I say the same thing.
Close you grow to people that you share them out with, the struggle, you guys are sharing the struggle, and
you took the words out of my mouth. You know, this conversation would not be complete without us talking a little bit more about Hickson, because he's your teacher, and he is, I mean, I don't need to tell you, but for those listening who don't know, he is, I would say, the icon of jiu-jitsu. And I've thought about it often, that the story of Hickson and his family, and when I say his family, I'm talking about his immediate personal family, it is something you could not script for a Hollywood movie, even if you wanted to. I mean, there's this guy who's the standout fighter of his family's mystical martial arts system, and he conquers everyone in Brazil and defeats these big monstrous wrestler dudes, one called Zulu. And, you know, then he comes to America and he fights in Japan and he wins over the Japanese. And then he has this son who passes away under these tragic circumstances. And then he has a younger son who takes the mantle from the son that passed away and fights for his name and has a picture of him inside his gi. And then he goes on to win all these championships. And I mean, it's like this, and it gives me goosebumps just thinking about it. It's such an amazing, amazing story. And so I wanted to just, you know, Hickson is surrounded by a lot of mystique, and I don't want to destroy any of that mystique, but I'd love to find out a little bit more from you about, and the question I've got written down here is what do you think, when did you know Hickson was a special person, and when did you realize that, like, how lucky you were to be training with him?
I mean, I always knew he was special. You know, that's why I sought him out. I heard he was the best, and you know, even Hoist was saying he was 10 times better, and in the Gracie in Actions they talk about Hickson being the best of all the brothers. So that's why I intentionally sought him out. I said, well, you know, I guess if I'm gonna dedicate my life to this, then I want to go learn from the best. And but God, there were so many during the years of training, so many reminders, you know, of like, wow, he's just on a completely another level, you know? So that's the thing, is like, when you're around a lot of time, you kind of forget, right?
Yeah.
And then
yeah,
you'll see these moments, or you'll have these experiences, or you'll get to witness these things, like these trainings behind closed doors where he was training with these black belts from Brazil, or this guy or that guy, like huge names, and seeing what he was able to do to these guys that were already kind of legends of their day. It was just like, wow.
Would you be able to share any specific details? I mean, I obviously don't want you to be dragging anyone's name through the dirt or anything like that, but I guess I don't think they'd really care if you just told the truth about what happened. I'd love to hear some of those stories.
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, a lot of these guys have already spoken out about it too. You know, like I saw when Faber Grigel came down and he was getting ready to fight Was he fighting Mark Kerr or Tom Erickson?
I think it was Mark Kerr, if I'm not
mistaken.
He was
fighting, he was getting ready to fight, and just watching Hickson train with him, and literally, you know, kind of just having his way with him, teaching him like he was a white belt, like showing him very, very basic moves and subtle things, like, you know. So that was like, you know, and everyone was like, oh my God, Faber Grigel's here, Faber Grigel. So I was a white belt at the time, and I had no idea who Faber Grigel was, but all of the Brazilians that were there training there was like, oh my God, he's a two-time world champion. You know, he's like the young up-and-coming guy that's kind of like the top guy right now. Mm-hmm. And then you see Hickson train with him and, you know, treat him like basically like a white belt. And a lot of the black belts, you know, these high level guys, would say that afterwards, like, man, I felt like a white belt when I trained with him. I felt like I couldn't do anything. You know, Fabio Leopoldo, who I think won the worlds once or twice. You know, I've seen Solo, Shanji train with Hickson, Roberto Travin, you know, a lot of these legendary black belts, you know. And
is that, yeah. If I could just ask you a little bit more about that, because I'm going to be straight up honest with you. I'm a huge fan of Hickson. It's huge, dude. Right. Mm-hmm. Remember, I had I'm so embarrassed to say this, but when my first academy was called the Grappling Factory, it was in Cape Town. I was 20 years old. I was probably blue belt level, and I was just teaching these guys the little that I knew. And we all had these official academy t-shirts, which would have your nickname on the back. And because I was such a huge fan of Hickson, my nickname was Hickson Fan, which sounds ridiculous at this point. But I mean, just to tell you how much I was an admirer of this guy. But, you know, I'd heard that he, like when you say to me, he could handle Shande and Saulo. I mean, mm-hmm. I find that kind of hard to believe that, like, with a 30 or 20 year age differential and a guy like Shande rolling with him. I mean, is that even possible? Is that even physically, humanly possible? I mean, could you tell me a little bit more about that?
I'll tell you a story that tripped me out. Sure. Hickson was 40 and he hadn't trained in 9 months because he had injured his groin. And so he'd come to the school one night to teach the class because Solo was in town, and Solo had just got back from winning the Pan Ams at the mm-hmm. time. I think it was Hawaii. But Hickson put everyone to train, put all of us to train, and he wasn't going to train, you know, but I think Solo asked him if he would train. And, you know, so this is Solo probably in the best shape of his life. Mm-hmm. And Hickson, 40 years old, hadn't trained in 9 months. And, they started rolling, and of course we're all training, and then we see they start rolling. All of a sudden everyone on the mat is sitting on the walls, you know?
Yeah,
so they're the only ones, rolling on the mat now.
Yeah.
And it was just such an epic battle, and it was super high pace, you know, and Hickson ended up catching him twice in probably about 9 minutes, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I saw Hickson do was, and this is one of the things that really helped me start to understand about weight distribution. He gassed Solo out, and, you know, that was something that was extremely impressive to me. And I asked him about it later on. I said, you know, what was going on? What happened there? And he said, man, I haven't trained in so long. I'm super, you know, I'm not in good shape. And I knew it was going to be a very, very high paced match. And so he said, I just wanted to make sure I was keeping my pressure and weight on him all the time so that if he was going to move, he was going to get tired. And so what happened is he ended up gassing Solo out before he got, you know, he got tired. And that was kind of one of my biggest introductions to weight distribution. And I was just like, wow, this is like, he's 40, Solo's in his 20s. And he was able to gas out someone that was, you know, in the base shape of their life, and 15 years younger, 15 or 13 or 14 years younger. So,
oh man, that's so cool to, cause you know, you hear these stories and it's just, it's told by a friend or a friend, or like they basically enter into legend, but to hear from someone who was sitting there on the edge of the mat and was an eyewitness to seeing this exact match play out, that's so cool for me. I mean, that's just made my week. Thank you so much for sharing that with me, Henry. I really appreciate
that. Yeah, no, the first time he caught him, it was, he got him from a, he got him twice, and the first time he caught him was with an arm lock from the closed guard.
Okay.
Solo stood up to try to open the legs, and he caught him with the arm lock from the closed guard, the one where you swallow the shoulder, and then, you know, he was so good. So yeah, high legs were really, and you know, you see Crone using that a lot. And Shanji, actually, you see Shanji using that in the past Abu Dhabi, that high closed guard where you swallow the shoulder. So he caught him with that. And what's funny is a couple months later, you know, I was talking to Hicks and I asked him about his, I said, what do you think your strongest position is? And surprisingly, he told me he thought his closed guard was his strongest position. He said he doesn't even think he could pass his closed guard.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which we kind of chuckled about that afterwards.
Yeah, that's cool. But,
you know, it's kind of a position that's not not so common these days. You don't see people playing closed guard so much these days. But yeah, he's developed that position to such a level. So cool.
So Henry, I wanted to ask you. You're known as an exceptionally good teacher, and I'm sure a lot of the people listening to this have asked, they either are jiu-jitsu teachers in some capacity or another, or they have aspirations to maybe teach one day. What do you think separates average teachers from great ones?
Gosh, there's a lot of things, I think. I think a great teacher can really simplify jiu-jitsu. I think sometimes people, when they teach jiu-jitsu, they try to make it too complicated, too complex. They try to they sometimes teach too much, overteach it.
Mm-hmm.
And really, jiu-jitsu is very, very simple. I mean, jiu-jitsu is very logical at the end of the day. Everything makes sense, you know? And so if you can break it down to your students so that it makes sense, so that they can actually internalize it, and after you explain it, they all of a sudden get it, I think that's really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny because people think, oh, I'm a good teacher, that I'm just a good teacher. But this is something that I've worked on for 20 years.
100%.
Teaching is not something that just comes natural to anybody. There are people that have a little bit of a propensity to become better teachers, mm-hmm. people that have a little bit more analytical minds. Like you see, John Danaher is, you know, obviously having a huge success with his students. And he's, you know, everyone says how analytical his mind is. But teaching itself is a skill, just like anything else that's developed. Mm-hmm. And you get better at teaching over time. When I first started teaching, I was not a good teacher.
I understand, yeah. You know. I also find it's a skill that can become rusty as well. I mean, I always think, okay, dude, I've taught thousands of jiu-jitsu classes in my life. And then I'll just think to myself, okay, cool. I'm great at teaching jiu-jitsu. That's cool. I got it. This is down. I got it down. And then I'll take a month break, or I'll be unable to, or for whatever reasons I won't be teaching, and I'll come back to teach my first class in a while, and I'm like, fuck, man, I'm out of practice. I'm like, I'm not even talking about the movements. I'm talking about engaging with people, and you get what I'm saying, right? Like,
oh, and you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because the same thing when I go teach seminars and when I go teach classes and stuff, I always go back and analyze my performance. And I was like, oh, I could have done that better. I took too long mm-hmm. explaining this, or I didn't time. So what's funny is, even for me, I'm constantly like critiquing my performance when I'm teaching and seeing if I could have done a better job, or seeing if I could have explained things better, or if there was one person having a problem, you know, how I could have dealt with that better. So I think those are the things too that really help you to become a better teacher, is that desire that you really want to become a better teacher. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's so interesting. I would like to tie this into something that's not necessarily jiu-jitsu related, but it's something that I've had on my mind for a long time. And that is my friend Roy Dean. He said that as a man, you're always paying your dues. And I realized that for the longest time I was looking at the world, and I had a faulty piece of software in my mind. And I was looking at the world in the incorrect way, because I'd always thought that, you know, that you would take something that you wanted to be good at, or take something about yourself that you wanted to change or acquire, and you would put the effort in and you would achieve it. So let's say you wanted to become good at jiu-jitsu. You go and you spend your 10 years doing your jiu-jitsu, and then you've got it. You've mastered that skill. Like when Neo says, when Neo's jacked into the Matrix and he's like, he plugs in and then he goes, I know jiu-jitsu. It's like, cool, I got it. But it doesn't work like that. It's a constant, never-ending thing. Everything, like your physique, right? If you like get in shape, it's not like you get in shape and then you're done. I'm in shape now. It's like you get in shape and you have to keep maintaining being in shape. It's the same with teaching jiu-jitsu or learning jiu-jitsu.
Maintaining and then extra effort to even improve or get better, right?
Exactly. You said it. Well, that's cool. Well, Henry, my man, that's the third podcast I've recorded in the last 2 hours. I've had back-to-back ones, and I could talk to you all day, but I'm feeling my mind is not quite fresh enough to keep up with your level of conversational wizardry. I want to thank you so, so much for coming on the show and sharing and being so vulnerable. And I really would like to meet you in person, and I'm going to try to make that happen as soon as possible. If the listeners wanted
stateside now, right?
Yes, I'm in Arizona as we speak, man. Not too
so
far away.
Congratulations. You're much closer now. So I'm sure we're going to make it happen in the next few months.
Definitely. So let's say someone wanted to find out more about you and your work and what you do. Where should they go?
So I have, if anyone's interested in my jiu-jitsu or my teaching, I have a website called hiddenjiu-jitsu.com, where they can see, and I have instructionals there for sale. Facebook, I'm pretty active on Facebook. So I have a Facebook page that people can like. Also, if people are ever in LA and want to stop by my gym or my school, it's Dynamics Martial Arts, and that's in Los Angeles. And we're very, very open to everyone from the outside. There's no kind of restrictions or anything like that. We're really easygoing, open to anyone that wants to come in and train or take a class. So
awesome. What a pleasure, Henry. That exceeded all my expectations. Thank you once again for your time, my brother.
Yeah, of course, Nick. Thank you so much for your time, too. And I appreciate you having me on.
I knew that was going to be a powerful episode, but I had no idea how powerful. That was right up there with my top 3 favorite episodes so far. What a cool dude. And I mean, that's the kind of that story he told about Hickson and Saulo. That's the kind of thing when I was 19 years old and I was in South Africa and struggling to find out anything about the wider jiu-jitsu world out there and having to get secondhand copies of that old publication, Grappling Magazine, and old VHS tapes and stuff. If you had told me that story when I was that age and in that time of my life, I probably would have lost my mind. And even now, when I'm a little bit jaded and a little bit less naive, and I've been in this industry for so long, hearing that story just blew my fucking mind. It was so cool. I'm so looking forward to going and meeting Henry and training with him and hanging out with him, and I'm sure we're gonna have him back on the show again soon. Okay, guys, peace out.